Hey everyone, welcome to Garden Fork Radio. You're here with Eric and my friend Leda. Hey.
Hey, how are you?
Did I just say your name wrong?
No, you just said it absolutely right.
Yay. Full disclosure, Leda and I know each other. Do we meet at a food swap?
I think we met at one of the BK Swapper events, yeah.
All right. Leda just came out with two books, and she lives in Brooklyn like I do, and she said, hey, I want to be on the show, and so here we are. Yay.
Yay.
So why don't you give us the elevator pitch?
Okay, sure. Well, the first book I had out this year is called Northeast Foraging, 120 Wild and Flavorful Edibles from Beach Plums to Wineberries. And it is a field guide to wild edible plants in the northeastern North America. It's not just U.S. It actually goes up into Canada and the area it covers a little bit. And it includes how to identify the plants, how to sustainably harvest them, suggestions on how to prepare them, and on how to preserve them. And that kind of leads to my next book that just came out in August, which is Preserving Everything. And it covers all the food preservation methods, so canning and dehydrating and freezing and fermenting and smoking and salting and so on and so forth. There are recipes in there, and I like to think they're great recipes, but the main thrust of the book is technique focused, so that you actually learn how each food preservation method works. And then, I know I'm not supposed to say this, but then you can actually make up your own recipes.
Yeah, I like that part of the book. Because everyone like hammers you about following the strict instructions, and you are like, look, as long as you blah, blah, blah. What I did really like about the Preserving Everything book was, first of all, I know you, and so I know that you know what you're talking about, but the design of the book is really good as well. We all see different kinds of books, and you either think they're either readable or not, and this one is very readable. So,
excellent.
A thank you to the book designer who...
At Countryman Press, and I'm very happy with the job they did on the layout. We talked a lot. I had some input on that as well, but they, basically gave me exactly what I wanted. So, and I wanted a book that would be easy for people to find the information that they're looking for, that would be easy on the eyes. So,
I like, of course, whenever we think of preserving, we think of, making sauerkraut, which is, I'm still struggle with. But what I liked about your way about it was I went out and bought let's just call it a large crock. I went to Brooklyn Kitchen and I bought the earth and stoneware crock, and I'm like, oh, I got to, and I'm thinking, oh, I have to get a plate to go inside this to hold down the cabbage. And you make it in mason jars.
Yep. No weights, no bricks, no nothing fancy, just a jar.
which just kind of made it much more simpler. So of course we're going to make it like that for Garden Fork. Because I kept on thinking, oh, I have to prepare the sauerkraut in the big crock, and I got to do this. And you just made it much easier for me.
Good. I'm glad. I think that comes up for people a lot, and I hope that Preserving Everything does make a lot of the different preserving methods more accessible for people and less intimidating, because I think we have this stored cultural memory of, somebody's grandma in the kitchen with the massive crock and 50 jars of tomato sauce and, that this large scale stuff. And the fact is that that's not practical for most of us. And we forget that mythical grandma probably had 10 kids to help her.
Yeah.
And most of us don't.
So you can scale it down, which is nice.
Exactly. Exactly. You can scale it. And of course, if you want to do the big amounts, absolutely, you can go for that. But there are other ways to do it on a smaller scale.
So it's kind of funny. So I don't have any wide mouth quart jars right now. So I'm like, I asked all my neighbors if they had any, and I just have to go out and buy. I only need two, but I have to go buy a case of them.
Yeah, and just when you're filling them up with that technique, I explain it in there. But instead of the weight that you would have in the crock, it's actually the lid of the jar itself that's holding the food in the brine. So you do go ahead for that method and you fill them all the way up to the rim. So unlike a canning recipe where you leave some headspace, no headspace in this one.
Right, because the lid of the mason jar does that for you. It keeps it just below the brine.
Exactly.
You know, another point you made in here was the fact that the ambient temperature does affect things more than I thought they would. And you, and a lot of times in the book you say, after the first couple of days where the ferment starts to bubble, you should put it in a cooler place.
Correct. If you don't, if you've got an active ferment going and it is bubbling, those happy probiotic bacteria are very, very temperature sensitive, and they proliferate when it's warmer. So do the not so friendly bacteria. But so what will happen is the fermentation process goes really, really fast, and you end up with a super sour, pungent food that can be mushy. And mushy is not usually a texture we're going for with sauerkraut or a dill pickle or something where we want some crunch.
Right.
So switching it, you know, once the slightly warmer room temperature kickstarts the fermentation, putting it into a refrigerator, or if you have a cold cellar, into that, just slows the fermentation down, and it still develops the flavors, develop that characteristic sourness, but you keep more of the crunch and the texture.
But again, I also liked, actually, let's just kind of back up and talk about what kind of fermentation we're doing here and why the food doesn't go bad.
Mm-hmm.
Because we're not used to just sticking stuff in a jar out on the counter.
No, you know what I find really fascinating? I mentioned this in the book because it's very intriguing to me that in an age when most people are really like microbe phobic,
you know,
they're running for the hand sanitizer like every 2 minutes. The most popular and like on the rise in popularity food preservation technique is fermentation, which relies on bacteria. So I find that contrast kind of interesting. But with fermentation, which is sauerkraut is a ferment, you are counting on healthy lactobacillus probiotic bacteria. Most people could think yogurt. It's the same genus as the healthy yogurt live cultures that are in there. And you're playing with the pH of the food. And the classic method is you start out with some salt. And the salt, like a salt brine or with sauerkraut, you can sometimes just salt in the cabbage. And the salt kills off any harmful bacteria. But those healthy probiotic bacteria are salt tolerant. So the salt has gotten rid of the bad guys, but the good guys are still there doing their thing. And they start to work on the food and actually shift the pH from salty, from alkaline, to acidic. And that's when you get that classic sauerkraut sourness.
Oh, cool. So the probiotic guys can deal with the salt, the salty brine, and the bad bugs don't do well with the salty brine.
Exactly. And that's the whole basis of that method.
And then the probiotic ones keep on multiplying, and they essentially overwhelm any bad bugs that are there.
They take over the neighborhood. And so you're just trying to create an environment that they will thrive in so that they can take care of anything else that needs taken care of. Once the probiotic bacteria take over in any healthy ferment, Korean kimchi is another food that's made this way, the bad guys don't have a chance. So once you've got a good probiotic ferment going, the food is safe. It's a question of how far do you let it go for flavor? Because the longer you let the fermentation go on, the more sour the food gets. And in the case of kimchi, where there's also like chili peppers and things in it, the more fiery and pungent it will get. But that's not a safety issue. That's just a flavor thing.
Right, right. Yeah, I'm not good with spicy food. So I want to like kimchi, but it's just too, it's just usually too hot for me, unfortunately.
Yeah.
What was one of the things you found when you're writing the book that people might not think that they can ferment, like a kind of food?
Fruit. Most people do not think about, they think savory, not using sweet foods. And you can ferment apples, you can ferment cherries. I have a pickled cherry recipe in there. This is something that's confusing for people. The word pickle and pickling refers to two totally different food preservation methods.
Yep.
And I think that mixes people up sometimes because there's the pickling that we're talking about just now with the sauerkraut and everything, and that's the fermentation process and with those probiotic bacteria. And then there's pickling, like vinegar pickling, where you're doing some kind of a vinaigrette-based brine, and you're introducing a lot of acidity right at the start, which kind of kills off everything in the neighborhood, including the probiotics, and safely preserves the food that way. And they're both referred to as pickling, so that confuses people. I think also canning, the word canning is really confusing for people because, first of all, we don't use cans anymore.
Yeah.
Mostly at home you're using jars, but if you say jarring, that's like an abrupt shock kind of a thing, which
it sounds weird.
It sounds weird. And then to mix things up even more, there are two very different kinds of canning. There's boiling water bath canning and there's pressure canning. And we use the same word for both of those. So I hope in the book that I demystify all of that a little bit.
I think you do. I mean, I knew about it before, but I read the book and then I just thought it kind of laid it out really nicely. What I hadn't thought about before was kind of using some leftover ferment from a previous project as like a starter culture for something that you're starting to ferment now.
That works so well that you can, in a lot of cases, actually either cut way down or even leave out the salt.
Yep.
In the initial brine, because if you introduce a little Kickstarter, basically you're taking the leftover juice from a previous successful ferment, which is teeming with those probiotic bacteria that you want, and you add that to your new batch, and that on its own, you can almost skip you can skip the salt because they'll take care of the safety factor for you.
I'm blanking where I read this in the book, but you also talk about using the whey from like yogurt. You know, when you open a thing of yogurt, your tub of yogurt, after you take a couple scoops out, there's a liquid that collects in there.
And that is whey, that sort of yellowish, clear liquid.
Yeah.
Which if you strain yogurt a little bit, you know, like to make Greek yogurt style, you know, thicker yogurt, that liquid that strains out of the yogurt, that's also whey. And that is full, assuming you started with a yogurt that says, you know, with live cultures on it, then you can absolutely use that as a ferment starter.
All these things we've learned. Cool.
Go forth and preserve.
I also liked in this, you talk about different methods. There's a sugared grapefruit slices. Is that correct? Something I hadn't thought about.
Candy. And it's actually the peel. It's the grapefruit peel that you're using. Rather than the pulp of it. And that's something I learned from my grandmother, actually. She used to make those, you know, we would eat a grapefruit half for breakfast, and she would always save the half of the rind that was left over. And we'd stockpile those in the fridge, and then she'd make those sugared grapefruit peels, which are really delicious. And it's also fun because it's kind of a something for nothing recipe.
Yeah.
You're using what you would normally throw out at compost.
I just threw mine in the compost this morning.
See that? That's actually, stay tuned. That's the next book, but it won't be out for a while.
Composting?
I'm working. There are plenty of people writing good composting books. I'm doing a something for nothing recipe book on ways to use peels and stems and cores and pits and seeds and all the stuff that we usually toss in the compost or throw out. And I started realizing just how many of those recipes I do have and use, and a few of them made it into the preserving book because I've got that grapefruit peel one, but I've also got how to use apple cores and peels. You can use them to make pectin and you can use them to make vinegar. Anyway, so that's what I'm playing with for the next one.
Neat. I've made a couple in the back of your book. You talk about making some cheeses and yogurt. Is yogurt technically a cheese or?
Yogurt is technically a cheese because it's a cultured milk product.
Oh, okay.
And that was really, I really debated, do I put yogurt in the fermentation chapter or do I put yogurt in the cheese chapter? And it ended up with the cheese because I figured people might be thinking dairy, go in that direction.
Yeah.
But it could actually have gone in either one.
I think it's good it's in the dairy section because it drives people toward other stuff that they might not have thought about.
Yep.
We've done one cheese video on Garden Fork, a really simple, like queso blanco kind of cheese, but it's wicked simple to make a basic cheese. And then from there, you can age it, you know, you can wrap it in salt and then age it or something.
Yep. And you can squeeze it and, you know, wrap it up in cheesecloth and hang it and drain it into a dryer cheese. The catch with doing home cheese making, the ones I have in the book are, you know, really, really simple. I think the feta is probably the most complicated one, and that's also pretty simple. But if you want to get into hard cheeses like cheddars and stuff like that, you really need some temperature control.
Yeah.
And a one bedroom in Brooklyn is not the best place for that.
I have a broken refrigerator in my basement that I'm saving, because I want to start learning how to cure like sausages and things, but also I thought I could make it into like a little cheese cave as well.
It'd be perfect for that.
Yeah, my Brooklyn cheese cave. So
cool, I want to come visit.
let's move on to our foraging book. And I've seen this actually in mushroom books as well, is that they almost have to be kind of regional, you know?
They absolutely have to be. Someone actually approached me about doing a field guide, similar kind of book for North America. And I was like, are you kidding? Because you've got desert and you've got mountains and you've got coastline and you've got swamps, and each one of those environments has radically different plants.
Yeah. It's a big country.
So even just narrowing it down for this book to the Northeast, it's a fairly big territory, but the plants are pretty consistent within that territory. So you can get down to all the way to like Maryland and up into Ontario and find a lot of the same plants. And those are what went into the book.
Well, I love that you talk about the Japanese knotweed as edible.
Yes, if you have it on your property, it is probably your foe, and you might as well be using it.
Oh, it's awful, this stuff.
It's one of the most invasive plants, and it's something I try to emphasize in the book. Like, for every plant entry, I say whether or not this is a plant that you have to worry about sustainability. In other words, could you over-harvest this and endanger the plant population? And there are some plants where that's an issue. Yep. There are things that, you know, have become kind of the darlings of restaurant chefs, like ramp.
Oh, don't get me started on ramps. Okay, this is the part of the interview where something went wrong, and the computer just stopped recording our call. So we were talking about ramps. They are edible, but they are endangered. But then we moved on to Japanese knotweed, and later was talking about Japanese knotweed, and then something happened. All of a sudden, the recording stopped and started again. So let's go to Leda talking about Japanese knotweed. Okay.
Is a non-native, incredibly invasive species, and you are actually helping to balance the ecosystem and give native plants a chance if you get rid of some of it. So in cases like that, harvest at will.
Do I usually have to get it when it's young, just sprouting through the ground, or can I cut the tops of like a 4-foot stem?
With knotweed, it's not a toxicity issue with the mature plant like it is with pokeweed and some others. You can eat the older plant. They just get really stringy and tough.
Okay.
So the best time to use them is when they're first shooting up, those first fat speckled stalks in the spring. And at that stage, the usual advice is use them like rhubarb. And they don't taste like rhubarb. They taste like Japanese knotweed. But they are sour and like rhubarb. And the texture is kind of like rhubarb. But then they have a different flavor on top of that that's just knotweed flavor. But I do take it like rhubarb as far as you can go sweet. You can do like Japanese knotweed compote, or you can go in savory direction and do a soup with them, which is pretty, kind of tastes like a sorrel soup.
All right. So almost when harvesting, it's kind of like asparagus. Yes. Asparagus is really tall, it's not worth harvesting.
Yep, exactly.
Not bad. What is one that kind of is a new one to you that you wrote about in the book?
The one thing that I had only done a very little bit with, that for the book I got the chance to go out and experiment and do more, is lotus. And if you've, you know, had Chinese food and there's that purplish colored spongy disc with the sort of holes in it,
yeah,
in a pattern, that's lotus root. And lotus root does, or lotus plants do grow wild. And there is a native American lotus. And then there's also the introduced Asian lotus, which has taken over in some places.
Yeah.
And it has several different edible parts. And I had had the root, but I hadn't worked a lot with the seeds before. And so writing the book, I got to do a lot more with that. And it was a lot of fun.
Cool. Before we start recording, we were talking about plantain, which grows in my yard, and I hate it.
Yes.
And I find that it's a medicinal plant, and you can eat it.
Yes, and you might as well, because if you have a driveway, you have it. Anybody. So plantain is an introduced plant, and one of its other names, Native Americans call it white man's footstep, because basically anywhere the Europeans went, this plant showed up at their feet. Probably wow. The seeds were just stuck on people's clothes or something. And it's a very common driveway weed. And as a topical first aid remedy, it is amazing. It is antibacterial, anti-inflammatory, and it's an anodyne, which means it's a painkiller. So if you rub a leaf on a mosquito bite, a bee sting, a scrape, you'll feel it within 30 seconds. The best way to use it, if it doesn't gross you out, is to actually chew up a leaf a little bit and then do a spit poultice. Just stick that wad of chewed up leaf on the mosquito bite and the itch will go away in 30 seconds, like amazingly.
Wow.
It's really good field first aid to know. And then, as a food, I was always underwhelmed with it. And this is actually a use that I discovered after writing the book. So if we go into a second edition, this goes in. but as a food, it is edible, but it's kind of just bland tasting. And the veins are a little bit stringy. Some people don't mind them, and that's fine. But anyway, so I thought I would try the kale chip recipe that I have in the preserving book, but on plantain leaves. And it worked beautifully well. That veininess just translated into nice crisp crunch, and they're really, really tasty. So that's what you can do with your hated driveway plants.
So I could pull this thing out of my yard and then I can put some oil on them and stick them in the broiler.
Absolutely. I did them a little lower than a broiler. I did them in a 250 oven.
Oh, okay.
Cause they're pretty thin. Basically, if you look in the Preserving Everything book and find the kale chip recipes, like the basic kale chip recipe, and just use plantain leaves.
Kale chips. That's just that in Brooklyn, that's a sign of gentrification when the store says kale chips.
But plantain chips have not yet arrived on the store shelves, I'm pretty sure.
Well, cool.
And by the way, just to clarify for everybody, the plantain we're talking about is not the banana-like plant.
Right.
That's a totally different tropical plant. This is Plantago major. It's a little driveway weed, very common garden weed.
Yeah, and it's in my yard, and I want it out. And
make chips.
Jeez. And it's got the root is kind of hard to get out when you're pulling it out. So anyway, I complain. So cool. So we'll link to your books, Preserving Everything and Northeast Foraging. Do you have a website if people want to come find you?
I do. They can just go to ledameredith.com, ledameredith.com. And also want to mention, if you're in the New York City area, I've got 2 foraging tours in Brooklyn coming up.
I forgot about that.
Yeah, one tomorrow in Prospect. And one in a week at Brooklyn Bridge Park. And I've also got an event. I'm going to do a talk at the Farm on Adderley restaurant on food preservation. And they're making some kind of cool pickles and things that they're going to serve people and some kind of cocktail. I don't know. I'm letting them figure that out. But I will be there with copies of the book to sign and talking food preservation to people. And that's on the 24th at the Farm on Adderley.
Cool. What fun.
It is fun.
All right. Well, thanks for taking the time. Full disclosure, one late was the organizer on this. I was not.
But you like the books anyway.
Pick a time, Eric. I'm like, oh, I can't. I'm not really good at that.
No worries.
All right, cool. So everyone, LaitaMeredith.com. And I'm kind of tongue-tied. I'm sorry. I need to go get some coffee. So
go get some coffee. Go get some coffee and pick some plantain leaves.
Is there any plants that have like a caffeine in them?
Well, there are several, but not that grow wild in the Northeast that I'm aware of. Sorry.
All right. I'll just go to the store then and buy my...
Just go to the store.
Get my kale chips. So... Okay. All right, everyone. Thank you for listening. We'll have another show next week, but we'll link to Leita's books. And if you're in Brooklyn, come see her. All right?
Garden Fork's theme music is used under license from UniqueTracks.com.